Let's consider the following situation. We had been talking about Hilchos Shabbos for a while, for a number of months before we moved to Hilchos Kashrus. So consider the following scenario. Someone's sick at home. No danger. No sakaras and fashas. Everyone's going to survive, but sick. Flu, strep. Someone's bedridden. And it's Shabbos afternoon, and they could really use something hot to drink, and the urn is empty. The urn is empty, the soup is cold, gosh. So what do you do? So, if someone's, have a real chola, chola shein bo sakana, but a real chola, just a headache, someone's sick in bed, so tzorach chola is one of the grounds, valid grounds to allow a mir l'nachri. So you're allowed to go knock in the next door non-Jewish neighbor's door. Say, do you mind making, if you're comfortable saying, do you mind making chicken soup? Do you mind putting up soup? Do you mind, cooking whatever it is for this Jew who's sick? And that is, sarachola is one of the situations, which Amir al-Akam is usually an Isser. That's one of the cases when it's mutter.
Why is that better than being over al-Tocha and taking Advil? Or taking medicine, meaning to make you feel better.
So if someone is a real chol shein bo sakana, then taking medication is mutter as well.
Right.
Right. Both
so
the isser.
But if you don't need both necessarily always, right? You don't always need a hot drink and a medicine to
okay.
make you feel better.
But let's say someone needs a. Someone does. So the tzarachola, so I'm, consider a scenario where the tzarachola, so you have the nachri, either a nachri who's in your house or now next door neighbor. Makes chicken soup. So here's a question. So, made a pot of chicken soup. So the chola had a bowl, two bowls, three bowls, right? Matzah Shabbos, someone wants to have, this is how often do you have fresh chicken soup on a Matzah Shabbos, right? This is a Shabbos afternoon chicken soup. So I make Havdalah. And
so they heat it up and they leave it on the.
Leave it on low fire, whatever.
Directly, like,
you can ask them to make ask them to make chicken soup. You can ask a nachri to do a malacha d'oraisa.
The
tzarachol.
What about the?
Or if someone again, just to clarify, that we're getting to the kashrus angle in a moment. But just to clarify, amir l'nachri is mutter for a chola, not what halacha calls mechesh b'alma. Someone just is uncomfortable. I have a headache, stomachache. But you're functioning normally, you're just uncomfortable. So that is not grounds to be matra and real akum. But if someone's really sick, again, no hazard, no pikuach nefesh, but sick, can't function normally. So then you're allowed to ask a nachri to turn on the lights, turn off the lights, to cook, and so on and so forth. Matzah Shabbos, you have leftover hot chicken soup. Fresh chicken soup. Sounds exciting.
Okay.
But now let's cross. At this point, it's no longer Hilchos Shabbos question.
Right.
Now it's a Bishul Akum question.
Right.
This chicken soup was made by a Nachri. Absolutely. It's a good thing it was made by a Nachri. It could not have been made by a Jew. It had to be made by a Nachri. So that sounds like bona fide Bishul Akum. And again, going back to last time, we had focused on the question of which ingredients are Bishul Akum sensitive. And we had said last time there are two major conditions. The Gemara lists. On the one hand, it's the sort of food that's inedible raw, so the cooking was critical. The cooking actually made it edible. And the cooking not only made it edible, but condition number two, the cooking made it something with some social significance. Ola shlocha malacha. And chicken soup definitely fits the bill. You're not going to have raw, you're not going to get raw chicken. And a nice, well-done chicken soup could be served in a formal context. So it looks like we have a real problem on our hands. A pot of chicken soup, and what are you going to do with it? So the Ramah, the last Ramah in Hilchos Bishul Akum, there's 16 paragraphs in Bishul Akum, Sif Tazayin, the very last Psak, the Ramah, he says, everyone can sit and enjoy chicken soup Matzah Shabbos. There's no problem Bishul Akum. No problem Bishul Akum. We know for sure, we sure hope that the one who cooked it was a Nachri. We would not have allowed Yisrael to cook soup for a Cholosh Imo Sakana. And the Ramah says, that's exactly why it's Mutter. He says, because it's an exceptional case, and because it's a case that, it's a scenario that highlights that we distinguish between Jews and Achram. And it's part of a larger idea that several Rishonim develop. That look, we were just talking a moment ago. The two conditions the food needs, the two criteria food needs to meet to qualify as bishalakim. Right? So the first one is it has to be inedible raw. Okay, and the cooking is actually accomplishing something. But the second one was it's not if the cooking accomplishes something, but it has to be socially significant. It has to be olal shulchan lachem. Why does it have to be socially significant? It's bishalakim. Right? Let's say it's not so fancy. It's still bishalakim. So the Rambam explains the whole rationale for the Isur of Bishul Akam in the first place. The reason why Chazal created this Rabban Bishul Akam was to prevent over-socializing between Jews and non-Jews. So he says that's why, as Rambam explains, that's why they only institute Bishul Akam when it's a socially significant food, something that could bring people together, and perhaps inappropriately so. So the Rama quotes from the Ra'ah and other Rishonim, when you have something, you already have a speed bump here. You have something that's highlighting that the very fact that in this scenario is allowed to ask the Nachri to cook. It was Shabbos. Only the Nachri could cook. That itself highlights the Havdalah Bein Yisrael Lamim, and that the concern of Chasnas, the concern of where the Bishul Akam could lead, is itself muted because it's such a unique situation, and specifically one that highlights the difference between Jews and non-Jews. And that's an interesting thing. It seems like a rarity. Let's talk about something much more common, where the same logic is at play. And that's, if you're following along on the outline, we're moving from 4a to 4b. What happens in the aftermath of the kitchen catastrophe, right? You walk into the kitchen, you discover that you have non-Jewish help in the house, and she decides your birthday, and she wants to surprise you with your favorite Spanish omelet, which was really sweet. Except that your Spanish omelet is bishul akam, right? Eggs, right? We developed last time the list of those foods that meet both criteria in our society tends to be meat, fish, eggs, certain vegetables are inedible raw, and many grain-based products. So a Spanish omelet, and not like messy-looking scrambled eggs that you would never serve. No, like a nice omelet. It's good. It was such a nice gesture. And it's absolutely trafe. So you obviously have to figure out you want to finesse the situation. And if someone wants to, obviously, sell you a banana chadera aspect, but you're not going to eat that omelet. You're going to figure out where it goes, where it gets put away for later. But no Jew can eat that omelet. Now the question is, no Jew can eat the omelet. How about the rest of your kitchen? So the omelet, I wasn't expecting the omelet anyways. But how about my frying pan? How about the pot? And how about the da-da-da-da-da? What do you do afterwards? So that's a machlokas, the same machlokas that we shown. Now, often you would have said, bishul akam is not kosher. So we know what the rules of kashrus are. If a food is, if you have a food which is not kosher, so the Torah tells us, tam ke'ikr, that the flavor is the same as the thing itself. So if I, we all know if you throw bacon into the challenge, not only can you not eat the bacon, you can't eat the rest of the challenge either, even though the rest of the challenge isn't non-kosher meat, but it has that flavor. So bishul akam is treif. So if the pots had absorbed that flavor, I'm going to need takasha. Other food absorb the flavor. Right? It should be an open and shut case. And yet, open Shulchan Aruch, and there's a machlokas in the aftermath of a bishul akam mess up. Do you have to kasha the kalim or do you not have to kasha kalim? What's the issue? So this is the issue. The Rashba says, look, it's not kosher, so you have the standard rules of tam ke'ikr, of transfer of flavor. The Ra'ah says, no, I don't think so. Because he says, it's not that the thing is kosher. The Ra'ah says, Chacham, we're trying to... The Ra'ah, Rav Aaron Halevi, was a contemporary of the Rashba, and he's the one who had said that the Shabbos situation, you can eat is exceptional. He says, this case is also. He says, what's Bishul Akam all about? It's about, we don't want you to eat that food that has the potential to create a socially risky situation. So Ra'ah says, the omelet itself, that's a problem. But the fact that later on you're going to make ratatouille in that pan. So what? The ratatouille has a little bit of flavor of eggs absorbed into it. That flavor of eggs doesn't have any social significance whatsoever. So the Ra'as, we don't treat it like regular non-kosher. It's all a question of, is there a concern of chasness or not? So in Shulchan Aruch, there's a machlokes. Everyone agrees that the eggs are bishlach and the eggs go in the garbage, but how about everything else? So the Pesach in Shulchan Aruch is that if it's fixable, we fix it. If it's not fixable, you keep it.
What does that mean?
In other words, if I catch the pot, so I have to kasher the pot before the next time I use it. If I have the pot that I'm able to kasher, I should kasher before the next time I use it, because that's something that's fixable. So I should when I can, as the Rashba would say, you better kasher that pot before the next time you use it. Okay. So I have the capacity to kasher the pot, kasher it. But if I already use the pot again, so the food does the ratatouille that I made in the pan of the pot later, the ratatouille doesn't have to go in the garbage. It's not fixable. There's no way to remove. You can't kosher food. So then you have the right to rely on the ra'ah, say, flavor is irrelevant, transfer flavor is irrelevant by a bishalakim. Or, let's say the bishalakim food went into a ceramic mug. The ceramic is not kosherable. So then we say, that's fine. If it's not kosherable, just use it. So that's why I say, if it's fixable, you fix it. If it's not fixable, then you have the right to eat whatever. Again, not the bishlachim food itself, but something, a food that indirectly picked up flavor from the initial bishlachim. Sometimes it requires a little calculating to figure out how you deal with it. I'm more than glad to talk this through. Should there be should this hypothetically speaking happen to a friend of yours? But if that happens to the best of us. But that's the principle, is that it's often not going to be as bad as you anticipate. The aftermath of the bishlachim food itself, you have to figure out if it qualifies or not. If it does, the actual food that was cooked by the nachri has to go in the garbage. But the rest of the aftermath is less collateral damage with a bishlachim catastrophe in the kitchen than with a basar b'chalav catastrophe, or I bought the wrong can of whatever, I bought the wrong package or whatever. Because bishlachim is sort of lives on the border, conceptually, it sort of lives on the border of non-kosher. It's not actually not kosher, it's more about, Chacham said don't eat this because they, I had said to use the word social engineering because it has such negative connotations. But Chazal were interested in setting us up for religious social success. They said avoid that food. But it's not that food is not kosher as much as something we don't eat. So that's why in a situation like, let's say, what happens to the pots and pans, so it's not quite as severe as something that's outright not kosher that made into pots and pans. Questions? Okay.
So
yes,
in
please.
In the case where you forgot to kosher the pot,
right,
and you used it, so then once you use it, then it doesn't matter anymore. Like,
so then,
you still go back and kosher it?
Yeah, because that'll help you with all the next 150 times you use the pot.
Okay, but even if you missed it the first time you missed it.
Right. So that's it. Right. Right. So whatever food is already made, the food doesn't. With the food, it's just a question of does it go in the garbage or you keep it. So there's no reason. So we're not going to tell you to waste the food. But the pot, it's not a question of do I throw it out or not. Kasher it. So you could use it without kasher. You could use it with kasher. You said and use it with kasher. But again, if it's something that's not kasherable, either because it's ceramic or because it's so worn and grooved that there's just not something that's not kasher. If it's not kasherable, and you have the right to use without kashering. But if you have the option to kasher, so then we would say, take the high road of the Rashba and kasher before you use it.
How do you kasher like a frying pan? Is that like a stupid question?
That's actually not a stupid question.
Especially
and
like
frying pans
like
are
non-stick.
Actually... Right, so frying pans are sometimes also not kasherable, especially since, we could talk about kashering more some other time, but just the basics of kashering is the first question you ask yourself, is how did the flavor get into this clay? And that'll tell me, the deeper it got in, the more robust, the stronger method I need to get it out. Usually whatever, the way it got in is the way I get it out. So if I have a pot that I cook in with fluid, so then you kosher it by putting it to boiling hot water. If you have something that you use with dry heat, we see that as being more severe. So you cannot, let's say you have a grill, or you have a spit or something like that, so you cannot just stick that into boiling hot water. You actually have to... Like, let's say, throw into a self-cleaning oven, right? Or if you have a son who likes to make forges, right? You're going to have to get it up to, like, 800-900 degrees, like a self-cleaning oven. Some things survive self-cleaning ovens and some things don't. Now, here's the thing. Frying pans. So frying, So sometimes you deep fry it, sometimes you pan fry. So if you're deep frying in a layer of oil, so that's liquid heat. But if you're just use PAM, you just add a little bit of spray, that's basically dry heat. So that really requires a much more severe kashering process, and oftentimes frying pans would not survive that type of guy. They're meant to get to 500, not meant to get to 900. So if you have a frying pan that wouldn't survive the type of kashering that it needs, so then you clean it off and keep using it, because there's nothing to do. It's either a question of throw it out or as is. But if it's a pot that I could kasher, or I have a grill, and the nachri grilled meat on the grill, or grilled fish on the grill. So you could kasher the grate, you could put it in the self-clean oven, and an hour from now, 2 hours from now, it'll be fine. So then that's what you got to do. But the frying pan is not going to survive the self-clean oven. So that's sort of, it's an interesting place. We would never normally say that. Well, if you could kasher, you kasher. If not, just use it. It seems so odd. But again, that's because the same logic that was driving that unique kula by Hilchos Shabbos. Bishul Akam is different than merely not kosher. Bishul Akam is goal driven. It's meant to create a certain reality. So these are sort of side pieces.
Okay.
Sure.
So sometimes, like, you're making a soup in a pot, but you first stir it by sautéing onions in like pan or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then you add a lot of water. So most of the time, this pot is used for liquid cooking, but sometimes it's used on occasion for dry.
Okay. I mean, you want to say you don't have to wash an extra pan, so you just sauté the onions at the bottom, right?
So which way do you kasher?
Well, it depends how it became treif. However, the treifus went in.
Okay.
So if you were sautéing treif onions, which is conceivable onions could be treif, so then you'd need to dry heat it. Again, assuming that you oftentimes when people sauté, they do use more oil. So it depends how you're working. Right. Okay.
But if
the treifus only arrived later when you put in the rest ingredients of the soup, and one of those ingredients was treif, so then the treif ingredient only went in via wet heat, so it's sufficient to draw it out through wet heat. Yeah.
Like the cover, a lot of the pot covers now are glass. So like, even if you could kosher the pot itself, let's say, the cover might be much more complicated.
So
like,
it would have to. Yeah,
do you kasher the pot but not the cover or whatever?
Assuming
this is very strange to me.
Should it come up, let's talk it through.
Okay.
Call or Newer, call me. Let's talk it through. But at the very least, so develop the ideas, and at the very least, it's important to remember. Now, in general, when there are kitchen catastrophes, things are often, and some of you know from conversations we've had, it's often not as bad as it looks at first. That's bechal. It's important to call, not just to please call first before you just assume that everything has to be thrown in the garbage. Before you throw out food, before you throw out pots and pans, lots of things. Kashrin is usually not so complicated, and sometimes kashrin is not even indicated, even outside the world of Bishul Akam. And not every time that a food was put where it shouldn't be does it have to be thrown in the garbage. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So it's always worth calling first. In Bishul Akam in particular, there's even more room to maneuver. Not endless. Sometimes things have to be tossed. But more to maneuver. Okay.
So can I just ask?
Sure.
So if a Jew just turns on the flame, that solves the concern of socialization? Is that like a...
Yes. So that's actually a great segue.
Okay.
And I appreciate your conceptual mind. It actually is a great segue. I was just thinking, as you raised your hand, maybe we should reorganize how we approach Section 5. And you did. And you did. Right. So the Gemara discusses, you know, if a Jew cooked the food, it's great. If a non-Jew cooked the food, assuming it's a Bishul Akam sensitive food, we have a problem. But how about if there was a blend of a Jew started, a non-Jew continued, a non-Jew started, a Jew continued. So how do you deal with those scenarios? So what emerges... La halacha is the following. If a Jew participates significantly, and we'll define terms in a moment, if a Jew participates significantly in the cooking process, whether at the beginning or at the end, is whether the Jew gets it started and the non-Jew continues, but the Jew played a significant role, or vice versa, non-Jew started, and these are this latter case is usually where people get more concerned. Like I walk in, a non-Jew got started, you can still jump in midway in the cooking and stick your finger in, literally or figuratively, and get involved in what's, you probably want to use a spoon. You might want to use your fingers on the dial of the stove. We'll get to that soon. But if I can participate with the beginning in a substantial way, so then that, the Gemara says, and then that's, if it's a joint effort of the Jew and a non-Jew, so it's not purely Bishul Akum. It wasn't only cooked by a non-Jew. It was cooked by the Jew and a non-Jew. Like, great, okay. And the Gemara says, it might be that the Jew puts the food on the fire, and then the non-Jew comes by and stirs it later. The non-Jew comes by and turns the fire up. It would have cooked even with a smaller fire, but it's going to cook more quickly, cook differently, right? Or vice versa. The non-Jew got started, and I come by and I stir it. I come by and I turn up the fire. So either way, that's fine. Either way is fine. Now, again, I mentioned either getting involved with the food or getting involved with the fire. That's true for Ashkenazim. Sfardim would assume that for Bishul Akum, you actually have to get involved with the food itself. And when the Gemara speaks about setting the fire, raising the fire, Sfardim assume that that's mostly just a reference to the halachas of Pasakim, bread making. But for food, you have to be involved. We know that for baking, getting the temperature just right is critical. If you've baked, you know that baking is 375, baking 425, you get radically different results. Cooking, fire's a little higher, fire's a little lower, it'll go, it's not going to be a radical difference. So that's why Sfaradim assume that it's, you're only participating significantly by food, by cooking, if you're actually involved with the food itself. Playing with the fire is not enough, but Ashkenazim do not make that distinction. I think most of us here are Ashkenazim. So if you're Ashkenazis, then you could participate and be matir the food, either by doing something to the food itself, stirring, something like that, or by raising the fire so it cooks better, so it cooks faster. So far, so good. Okay, seems pretty straightforward. The Jew and non-Jew are both partners in the cooking. That's not Bishul Akum. That's Bishul Akum v'Yisrael. Then Ashkenazim have a further set of kulos, which becomes surprising. And this idea goes back well over 1,000 years to writings of the Gaonim. It has a sefer that talks about some of the differences in halachic practice between the Jews who lived in Babel and Jews who lived in Eretz Israel, two major Jewish communities, 1,300 years ago. So one of them was this. Raising the fire is one thing, or we talk about turning the dial once upon a time, and you put another log in the fire. Okay. But I don't have any logs. We're out of logs. I just take a matchstick and I throw a big blazing fire. I throw in a little piece of wood. What did that do? Nothing. Nothing significant. Ashkenazim assume that's fine. That's hashlochas kissim. You threw in a little stick of a little matchstick of wood. Nothing significant. Or Ashkenazim go a step further and they even talk about esh me esh. The Jew didn't even light the fire that's being used for the cooking. I lit a candle, and I told the Nachri, when you're ready to turn the fire, use this candle to turn the fire. I lit fire one, but fire two is actually used for cooking. Or I turn on the pilot light, and then but no one's cooking on the pilot light. So that's what we call Esh Me'esh. So you look at that and you wonder, well, how does it accomplish anything? It's not, I didn't cook it. From a Hilchos Shabbos perspective, you never say that I violated cooking because I lit the fire that you used to cook something. What does it do with me? It's not my cooking. So the answer is exactly what we said. The rationale to allow this, and Ashkenazim do allow this, is the same as the Ra'al we discussed before. It's true that I'm not actually the cooking was done by the non-Jew, but I was tweaking the situation in an unusual way. We didn't just let this develop naturally, whoever is making the food cooks fire. No, it has to be, you lit the fire from that fire. Or I did something. I didn't actually substantially contribute to the cooking, but I did something that's a reminder that this is an unusual situation, a hecker. And that suffices. So let's review. Let's review where we're at. You could be matir, you could have a case where the Jew is participating by putting the food on the fire, even if the non-Jew stirs more, adds more later. Or you could raise the fire, or you could even have participated in advance by setting the fire up, or even by providing the pilot light from which the cooking fire ultimately comes. Here's one thing you should not do. And that's why I said item number two is freeze. The one thing you definitely don't want to do is you walk into the kitchen and you realize to your dismay that the non-Jew put the food on the fire. You thought they were just doing prep. It turns out the non-Jew didn't just cut the vegetables and skin the chicken. And non-Jew decided to be helpful and put the soup up. And you walk in and you realize that the soup has been bubbling away for the last hour and a half. Saying that, right? The red flags are off, alarm bells are ringing, and your natural reaction might be, get it off the fire as soon as possible. Let's yank it off. That's the one thing you don't want to do. For the following reason. As long as the Nachri put the chicken soup on, the raw chicken soup on the fire. So now it's cooking. It's been cooking since 9 o'clock in the morning, and now it's 10:30, it's still going. So the non-Jew began an act of Bishul. That session of Bishul is still going. So if I involve myself in that session of Bishul, I stir, I raise a fire, I do something to participate in that Bishul session. So that means that session of Bishul, which may go on for another hour, two or three, however long you like, to leave your soup going, that will have been a collaborative effort of the non-Jew and the Jew. And that's mutter. If it comes off the fire, though, so that ends that session of Bishul. You can put it back on, but the question is, how long did it go the first time around? It may have already gone long enough the first time around, and now it's already locked in. And so again, that gets a little more complicated. You put it back on as a mutter or not, but that's the most dangerous thing to do, potentially, is to take it off. Because then you're ending, if you just take it off, the non-Jew put the food on an hour ago, all you do is take it off, you just ended that session, and it was handled entirely by the Nachri. So that's the last thing you want to do. You want to always, that's perhaps a...
At what point is your participation won't help anymore?
If it's fully done, so that's another area that needs to be worked through. As long as it's not ready and it's on the fire, your participation helps. It does get kind of, if it's on the fire but it's already fully done, it's ready to come off. So at that point, you may have passed the point of no return. So you gotta. It's always worth stirring first, stir first and then ask, or stir first and then take it off.
The fire help or only raising?
Suppose I've been wondering about that. So sometimes it is what the food needs. Post can usually talk, and the Gemara talks about here of Bishul in the sense of accelerating things. So I would advocate raising the fire. Raise the fire, stir the food. Two things on this topic. Number one, there's sort of the Dvar Musar that comes out of here. This is a specific halachic example for the more general, for the Mesil Sisharm. This is sort of the first step in growth as an Eved Hashem, is to think before acting. Or, what the thing psychologists talk about is, having the T between the S and the R. Instead of just having a straight arrow from stimulus to response, to train yourself to think first, instead of just shooting from the hip. And if Ramchal writes, devotes several Prakim Seals of Charm to that. The first step in an organized, methodical trajectory of growth is to live contemplatively and to act out of thought instead of just whatever. It's also, this has happened to one very specific example of you often gain by thinking first and acting second. It's also worth pointing out this difference between Ashkenazim and Sephardim in terms of whether participating just by handling the fire is sufficient, which is Ashkenazi approach, or the Sephardic approach that you have to actually get involved with the food. So that, if you have Sephardic friends, that actually is very impactful in industrial settings and in restaurants. At home, if you're negotiating a situation like this at home, it's often not hard to be involved with the food. It may be natural. But if you're giving hashkacha on a canning plant, or giving hashkacha on a restaurant, So what's that going to look? If you have Nachrim handling the managing the equipment, or you have a Nachri chef, so how are you going to avoid the problem of Bishul Akum? Assuming that the food is a Bishul Akum sensitive, and they're just making baked apples. The most practical way to set it up is the Jews. When the Mashgiach comes in, unlocks the kitchen, so he turns on the fires, turns on all the fires, and then the cooking staff use those fires for the next X number of hours, which works perfectly fine for Ashkenazim, but is useless for Sephardim. So for a Sephardi to eat in a restaurant is a lot more complicated. There are Hashkacha organizations, I'm told, that actually part of the agreement with the restaurant is that Sephardic patrons have the right to ask to come back and actually, you know, stir the wok. Because Mashkiach, he's not going to tell the Mashkiach he has to stir every wok. He's not going to have to stir every pan. But that's it makes life more complicated.
Can I ask a very loosely connected question that you're just reminding me of in terms of Sephardim and Ashkenaz? Is there ever a time that if one person is doing something that is okay for themselves, an Ashkenaz or Sephardim, depending, it's okay for them? You know, an obvious extreme example might be Kitnios on Pesach, if it's okay for them and not for the Ashkenaz. But is that equivalent to other things, such as on Shabbos? It just reminded me, I'm sorry to digress, but a Sephardi friend...
Par for the course.
They can make tea regular on Shabbos. And if they're making it for themselves, can I have it too?
Regular meaning in the cliché. Right,
they just put the tea bag in.
And so the...
As I would also. So if you come to my house and I pour water from the urn into a mug and put the tea bag in the mug, and your practice is to only rely, to assume that tea is Kali Abishal, and that you would only want to use sense.
Or in this case, and I don't know if this is more severe, so, you know, at a restaurant...
No, that's pretty severe.
So can you share, right? So the Ashkenaz person is eating the food that's okay for them in terms of Pasakum, in terms of Bishul Akum, whatever their practices are as an Ashkenaz. So can the Sephardi person share, you know, hey, I'm going to order a meat dish, can they share it?
I think the Shabbos case you're fine, and the Bishul Akum case you're not. The Shabbos case you're fine because the Mishnah Berurah periodically over the course of Hilchos Shabbos quotes as comes the Prima Gadim that although it is true that sometimes the results of Chil Shabbos are forbidden, and we call Masa Shabbos. If a Jew is Mechal Shabbos and cooked or did whatever, so we don't allow, again, the details of that Jew versus someone else using it on Shabbos, after Shabbos, but certainly over the course of Shabbos, we're often going to say you can't enjoy whatever the outcome of the Malacha. That's called Masa Shabbos. Prima Gadim says Masa Shabbos is, we waive the Isser of Masa Shabbos if there's a significant shita that holds that behavior is mutter. Even if we don't follow that shita, we would not, if you said, can I do that? No. But if it was already done, it doesn't make the results forbidden. So certainly, if you have someone who holds, that's mutter. Or even if not, let's say I forgot. Let's say I don't make tea with a bag on Shabbos. And I forgot, and I just sort of out of rote made tea, and then I realized. I say, well, if... I wouldn't do it again, if that's my psak, but I'm allowed to drink that tea. But that's because it's dealing with the Maisa Shabbos, where it's a question of dealing with the results of a potential Masa Issa. So there, if that Masa is not Asur L'Chaldeis, then the act is forbidden, but the results are permitted. But here, it's not a question of act and results. Here, this food is Bishul Akum according to Sephardim, it's not Bishul Akum according to Ashkenazim. So it's very nice that the Ashkenazi ordered the food, but it doesn't make it mutter for the Sephardi, I don't think. The kinyas are post-kum discussed. Kinyas are different kinyas than minhag.
They're not going to be able to say, why should they be able to eat only black? You know what I'm saying?
Shabbos is mutter because of that prima gadim of the Meister Shabbos. But I think Bishul Akum, if I hold this mutter, you hold zasser, so then I can't eat it, you can't eat it. I'm not sure there's that much, not sure how much wiggle room there would be. Another practical impact of this. So the most extreme application, cooler, what have you, it's important to remember that sort of this question of Jewish, but if the Jew already cooked it, she was involved in the cooking. So the easiest scenario is the Jew already cooked it, and then the non-Jew rewarms it. So rewarming is never a problem because it was already cooked beheter. It's cooked beheter, even if it was cold. And it's the sort of thing I wouldn't enjoy cold. Chicken soup. Who's eating cold chicken soup? Gazpacho maybe, but chicken soup. Who's eating cold chicken soup? So the Jew made the chicken soup, and it was in the fridge. And Nandra took it out, put it back on the fire, rewarmed it, Heter Gummer. Because that's even better than the Jew star the Nandra continued. There was a Bishul session that was entirely Jewish, and now it's done. So now it'll be Mutter forever.
And of course this doesn't apply for reheating.
Right. As I was saying, reheating is Mutter. There are no limitations. There are no, let me say that again. There are no Bishul Akum limitations on reheating. There are kashrus limitations. Right, so if you made... Correct, so if you made eggs and then you leave them to be rewarmed, that's totally fine. As a matter of fact, you could even do the following. You could even make the eggs two-thirds of the way. And let's say you don't want to reheat it. It depends who your customers are. Right, so some people, customers don't really care. If you reheat it, it's fine. And other people are more finicky eaters. So if you deal with more finicky eaters and your approach is to enable the finicky eating, so then you might stand in your head and say, well, I'll make the eggs, but I'll take it off the fire 2 minutes before it's ready, so that when it goes back on the fire, it won't get overdone, it'll be just right. So that, too, is fine, because the Jew already got it most of the way cooked. Mutter. And Nadju puts it on and finishes off, that's not a problem.
And no assistance is required for that, for the reheating process.
No assistance, right. Mm-hmm. Again, there's no Bishul Akum sensitivity in the reheating process, but you have to make sure that all of your kelim, that everything is b'chalav, and that's a larger discussion maybe for a different time, but maybe this is a good point to end with. Because we've covered at this point the major issues of Bishul Akum, but an important point to end with, and maybe this will transition to the next, I'm not sure what Neuber is planning to talk about in 2 weeks, but he may be talking about, I think, some of the following. When you have Nachrim in your house, aside from the specifics of Bishul Akum, if you have Nachrim who are unattended and unsupervised in your house, that carries with it a lot of risks. And it needs to be navigated with a lot of thought. And part of that is that the Nachri realizes that if there are any mess-ups, reporting them will not get you into any trouble, and not reporting them is a very, very severe violation. But you have to have... If a Nachri is doing stuff in the kitchen without Jewish involvement and that Jewish supervision, so oftentimes it makes more sense to have very, very limited. All a Nachri does is reheat things in the toaster oven. You leave the pan of food, the toaster pan is in the fridge, and they can reheat it. That's totally, everything is straightforward, totally fine. You have to have, so the general kashrus issues have to be set up well. But in terms of Bishul Akum, assuming the food's already done, Bishul Akum is not going to be a problem. So if you have pasta and cheese, for instance, so the pasta you already made, so that's fine. The cheese is Nechal Chai, that's also fine. The sauce, number one, tomatoes are Nechal Chai, and number two, the sauce was already cooked, the heter, in the plant. But assuming you do that, and then you have your kashrus set up, So then you should be. You can definitely not worry about the Bishul Akum considerations. I hope this shiur helped more than it confused. So I know that some of these issues are more complex issues, and I hope if you're taking thorough notes, that's good. I'll look and you have all the complexity. Okay. So it should. I was just looking at the clock and already getting close to overtime. But that's quick. electricians versus intent. Another sort of detail, it doesn't come up that often, but another detail that the Gemara has is that even if the Nachri did the entire cooking and the food is inedible raw, and by the time they're done, it's very edible. It's Olah Shel Chamlachim. It's only going to qualify as Bishalachim if the Nachri intended to cook. If the Nachri did something without intent to cook and sort of inadvertently ended up causing cooking too, that's Mutter. The Gemara gives this sort of funny scenario. As you'll see in a moment, it's funny on a number of levels. The Gemara talks about the Nachri who was trying to like smoke some sort of like swampy area. And they're trying to drain it. I'm not sure what they're trying to do. They scorched this swampy meadow. And they try to get rid of the grass, they try to get rid of the mud, whatever it was. There happened to be a whole colony of kosher grasshoppers in the grass, and they got toasted by the fire. Right? Of course, we all love grasshoppers, kosher grasshoppers. The Gemara says, that's not Bishalachim, because the Nachri had no intent to toast the grasshoppers. Okay. So you're looking at me like, now you know what I was saying. This is not so. The answer of it, is this ever relevant? So I'll give you, what does that have to do with an electrician? So the most reasonable example I could think of is the following. Erev Shabbos, things always happen in Erev Shabbos, right? So if you're going to blow a few, if the circuit breaker is going to go, it's obviously going to be, chances are Murphy's Law is going to happen Erev Shabbos afternoon. Right? Baruch Hashem, said Baruch Hashem, then you managed to get an electrician to come before Shabbos, and he went down to the basement and did whatever magic he did, and now your electrical system is up and running. Everything in the house was black, and now, boom, 20 minutes before Shabbos, your house is up and running again. Gevaldik. Fantastic. Baruch Hashem, we made it. Pay the electrician, thank you so much. A beautiful Shabbos. Everything that you worried what's going to be, great. Shabbos morning, you walk into the kitchen. You realize, one second. Let's say it wasn't 20 minutes before Shabbos. Let's say it was 2 hours before Shabbos. Right? Say, 1 second. When the Nachri, the non-Jewish electrician, turns the juice on back in my house, that means the non-Jewish electrician turned on essentially every single appliance in my house at once by flipping the switch in the basement, so to speak. That includes the urn, and that includes the chompa. And that includes the plata. Now, so let's think about that. So the urn is not a problem because water is drinkable cold, so heating water is not a bishlakim problem. Nechachai. The plata, you weren't cooking on them. Everything on the pot was already cooked anyway. It's just a question of rewarming. But the chalon pot, so if the food was already, if the chalon had been on long enough that you got it to at least a third cooked, to machal ben drusai, okay. So then you already did some minimal cooking. It went off. The nachri basically put it, so to speak, back on the fire. So I'm good to go. But let's say it was it's your chalon pot that killed the electricity in the whole house. That's what blew the fuse. And the chalent had only been on for 5 minutes, or 5 seconds, when the electricity went out. And the Nachri basically essentially plugged your chalent pot in. And cooked, from me, Tchil, Vatso, you were uninvolved. You had chugged the plug in the chalent pot, but it basically came off the fire. The electricity went out, 10 minutes in, and the entire cooking, from 5% to 100%, was done by the Nachri. And the chalent is definitely, you have meat in there, you have potatoes in there. And again, Olah Shel Chamlachim, I'll leave you to decide whether the chalent is Olah Shel Chamlachim or not. But I think in a Jewish context, you would serve that chalent at a fancy Shabbos dinner. Absolutely. And you have a catered Shabbos Shabbat Brachas, you would definitely serve chalent. So that's a problem. So the water, the urn is fine. And the stuff in the plata is fine. But your chalent, Gevalt, what happened to your chalent? Bishalachim.
Preparing it before, like putting everything in the pot, isn't considered part of the process.
Yeah, it is. Except it would be. In other words, I'm not sure putting it in, but putting it on the fire would be. Except that here, essentially, it came off the fire because.
But why does that negate that you did it first?
Because that's what we were talking about before. If you have two separate sessions of cooking. And before he said, let's say the Nachri put it on and you took it off, that ends that session of cooking. Here it's true as well. As I put it on, but then it got taken off when it was still raw. It's not that the Nachri came by, I put on the fire, Nachri comes by and stirs it. Nachri comes by and turns on the fire, turns the fire further up. That was a single cooking session we both participated. But if it came off, went back on, so then each session is separate. And if the first session was too short to actually accomplish cooking, it was still raw, then entire cooking was really the second session. So how are you going to save this chult? So we'll end the shiur by saving the chult. Because the grasshoppers save the chult. You don't have to put grasshoppers in your chult. But the gemar of the grasshopper saves your chult. Because unless you told the electrician, if you're part of the sob story, the electrician, you got to help me, we have a chult. Maybe you did. So sometimes sharing less is wiser. Because an electrician probably doesn't know that by turning the fire, if you ask him or her, what are you doing by getting the electricity back on, let's say, the air conditioning, the lights, the oven maybe, you know, there's different appliances. They're not thinking of the crock pot. It did not occur to them that they're cooking your food by turning on electricity in your house. So that is exactly the case of the grasshopper. The nachri is trying to do something and succeeds in doing it, which ends up resulting in, from the point of view of the nachri, inadvertent, unintended cooking. So cooking without kavanas bishul is mutter. So assuming the nachri was not aware that re-electrifying your house would be directly cooking food, so even though the food was eon echachai, and it's olal shulchan lachem, and essentially the entire cooking session, the session of cooking that actually got the cooking done, was done solely through non-Jewish participation. But still, because there was no kavana levasha on the part of the nachri, and it was entire shalom miskaving, and the logic is the same. Yes, the nachri technically did bishal akum, the nachri cooked it, but if there wasn't even intent to cook, so the notion that there's a concern of chasnas is greatly reduced. So that the interplay of a kashrus issue, technicalities of did the nachri cook it, together with the overlay of the rationale for this, is not that the food inherently is treif. I'm not allowed to eat the food, but that's because of the need to maintain havdalah ben Yisrael amim. So sometimes, if I maintain that havdalah, then the food will be mutter. Thank you so much. And once again, please feel free to reach out with Shiloh.